So the last teaching was mainly focused on the Indian audience, and there was a Hindi translation from the stage. Today, here there are many ethnic Mongolian people gathered. And also, together with them, we have many devoted or faithful people, monastics, as well as lay people, to whom I will be giving this Dharma discourse. And the teaching that we are faithful in is the teaching of the Buddha, that of Buddhism. So whatever teachings you engage in the discourse, you should have a perfect or pure motivation on the part of the Lama. The Lamas should not expect fame, name, and wealth, and so forth, because doing so would be sinful, though one may be teaching the Buddha Dharma. And especially doing business with the Dharma is really negative. So one Nyingma master, I think Dugul Tsulu, made three pledges. First one is not taking non-vegetarian meals. Second is not riding animals for transportation. And the third one is not selling dharma. And so I was really inspired by these three pledges that he had made. And people here, who may be here with the speculation what the dharma would be about, it's okay to listen to this kind of teaching. So, with regard to the teaching of the Buddha, we don't need to feel hesitation on whether whoever comes to the teachings. We have nothing to hide. And so, for over 2,000 years, there have been many generations of people who have challenged posed challenges to the teaching of the Buddha, and then there were responses to them as well, and still the teaching of the Buddha, the Nalanda tradition, has survived through logic. And today, even today, if there are people who criticize the teaching of the Buddha, who have no faith in the Buddha and Buddhism, even the Buddha, when he though he appeared in the supreme Nirmanakaya form of a Buddha, he was even criticized by people. And so today here we have a gathering of monks, nuns, and lay people, and most of the people here are gathered are traditionally Buddhist. Tibetans and Chinese also traditionally are Buddhists. and the Heart Sutra was recited by the Chinese with a cacophony of voice. So otherwise, they do recite it well, the Heart Sutra. So we have... And then they do well. And then at the end, they would recite a verse which says, may the three poisons be eliminated. And this should be done through wisdom, not merely through faith. And then the next line says, may the light of wisdom ablaze or shine forth. And so these are the foundation of the teaching of the Buddha. And then the next line says, may that we not face any obstacles, internal and external. And then the last line in this verse says, may I train in the Bodhisattva path. So what does this this verse show us is that the Chinese have been traditionally Buddhists and developing it within in which tradition we have the practice of developing wisdom. And so here, wisdom doesn't mean anything that knows any kind of a knowledge. But we are talking about wisdom realizing selflessness. And so the fourth line in this prayer says, may I engage in the Bodhisattva practices. And so, which is very good. And so, the Chinese are traditionally Buddhists, and even today, of course, after the huge destruction and the turmoil they had gone through during the Cultural Revolution, so of course the transformation or the religious faith and so forth cannot be obliterated and eliminated through force. And so today we have in China number of Buddhist population growing. And then we have here Mongolians. And so within Mongolia, there are three phases of the dissemination of Buddhism. It may be true when Chinese were when traveling on through the Silk Route, they have passed through the Mongolian region, and therefore that must have influenced the dissemination of Buddhism. And then during the Sakya times, the Mongolians had some relationship with Tibetan leaders. And then the third phase was after the third Dalai Lama visited the Mongolia. And the Mongolians have given him the title Dalai Bakshi, which means Dalai Lama. So Dalai is a Mongolian word. And so in this way, we have the three phases of this dissemination of Buddhism in Mongolia, the great nation of Mongolia. And therefore, Buddhism to Mongolia spread from Tibet. So when I visited Mongolia in 1979, the first time, I had communicated with the elderly Mongolian monks, and they couldn't speak Tibetan, but they communicated in writing with me. So I wrote the responses to them, and they wrote what they wanted to say to me. And so in those days, within the Gaden Thekchenling Monastery, it seemed that they had some freedom to practice Buddhism outside of the premise, no. And they would recite the prayers and mandala offering prayers. so loudly that their face turned red. And so when they recited this in a loud tone, they took me back to those times of the third Dalai Lama and the Sonam Gyatso, and then with whom the Mongolians had a very strong tie. And then the fourth Dalai Lama, Yuendin Gyatso, also was born in Mongolia. And then during the fifth Dalai Lama, Losan Gyatso's time, also the Mongolians and Tibetans had a very strong tie. And many Mongolian masters have appeared in the past. Even today, we have the writings. We have the access to their writings. And so the great nation of Hor, Mongolia, of course, went through a great decline and through the destruction of monasteries and the killing of the monks. And so they went through a great hardship in those times. But today, Buddhism is being revived in Mongolia, and it's gaining strength. And so in our monastic institutions in South India, we have few hundred Mongolian students studying Buddhist philosophy, logic, and so forth. And in the future, because of this strong, special, unique tie between the Mongolians and the Tibetans, although we Tibetans are in exile, historically, because we have a very strong tie, this would continue. And regarding myself, the best tenship, assistant, debate assistant to me in my childhood was a Mongolian master, Ngudup Chongye. And he was the one who inspired me to take special interest in the view of Madhyamaka. And so today we have the Mongolian Lama whose name, title is Lame Gegen. So perhaps he's in one of his previous lives, he was the teacher to Kalka Jetun Thampa, the head Lama of Mongolia. And so because of that, he got this title Lame Gegen, which literally means master of the Lama, referring to Kalka Jetun. And so there are a few scholars of Mongolians here too, and so who are studying Buddhist philosophy in our monastic institutions. So I have advised them to keep up with their study of philosophy. And so we have a very unique connection between the Tibetans and the Buddhists. And so I have told the Mongolians how important it is to the focus on to pursue the study of Buddhist philosophy. And then we have many people from the Himalayan regions, and from where many monks and nuns monks are also studying in the monastic, the large monastic institutions, the seats of learning. And when the flow of monks from Tibet were stopped in those early days, we had the Himalayan people joining our monastic institutions of learning, and who really have served the Dharma by joining these institutions. Of course, I have to thank you all. So while I say thank you to you, you should also feel grateful to us Tibetans, because since we became exiled, the Himalayan regions also developed and made progress. Otherwise, you would have followed the traditional way of doing some rituals and prayers only, and therefore you should feel grateful. So Jesus Milarepa has said that gratitude should be two ways. So you should also feel grateful to us, Tibetans. And then there are other foreigners, quite a number of you here. Sorry. So please raise your hands, those of you, Europeans and foreigners. Raise your hands, please. So quite a number of you are gathered here. You were not traditionally Buddhist in Europe and America. You were followed Judeo-Christian. Your background, religious background, is Judeo-Christian, and so you didn't have any connection with Buddhism. But in the 20th century, when people communications and the connections between people and increased in the 20th century, and Westerners took interest took interest in Tibetan culture, Tibetan religion, and also there are people who have taken special responsibility on themselves to support us, and because of their interest in Tibetan culture, the number of people taking interest in Tibetan Buddhist tradition also is increasing year by year. And so traditionally, though you are not Buddhist, you use your intelligence, this intellect, and feel inspired by the teaching of the Buddha. So historically, you are new Buddhist followers. So us, Tibetans and Himalayans and so forth, we are old Buddhists, having followed the tradition for over 1,000 years. So you are new disciples. I welcome you.
We, as an old, the historical old sort of follower of Buddha Dharma, you are new one. So from old one, welcome you. Okay. What did you say?
So that's what I wish to say. So when we talk about giving a Dharma discourse, it's not about following some kind of a formality by the Lama, with the Lama sitting on a throne, but regarding the teaching of the Buddha, of course, religion, regarding religion, we have Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and so forth, and non-Buddhist traditions, many different kinds. So all of these are religious religions. So the difference is, difference lies in the philosophical view. So it's important to explain the Buddhist philosophy and how to proceed with the practice of Buddhism. So therefore, I first, as usual, give an introduction to the Buddhism and then teach the practice of Buddhism without really being introduced to the teaching of the Buddha. I mean, even if you may say, I take refuge in the Lama, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and so forth, it may not have much meaning. And therefore, to introduce to the teaching of the Buddha, it should be done through the philosophical ideas. So within the Buddhist tradition itself, there are the four different philosophical schools of Tenet, and which are Vaibhashika, Sautantrika, Chittamatra, and Madhyamaka. And within each of these, there are subdivisions as well. So all of these followers of these traditions are Buddhists, the follower of the same teacher. And because of this, the different mental dispositions of these disciples, the Buddha himself also accordingly taught the philosophical views differently to different people. And so there is an individual liberation tradition, in which their followers seek to reach liberation for their own sake. And then there are those who desire and aspire to become a fully enlightened Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings. And so, because of the differences in the spiritual and mental capacities of the followers of the Buddha, there are those of the teachings given to the Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and the Bodhisattvas. And so, because of the philosophical differences, there are these four philosophical schools of thought, and therefore it is very important to introduce to the teaching of the Buddha. And therefore, for this purpose, I am teaching Master Nagarjuna's commentary to the Awakening Mind, or Bodhicitta Vivarana. All of you have this text? Please raise your books. If you have the book, so the Mongolians also have.
Oh yeah.
So I consider this something important. On the one hand, it is authored by Master Nagarjuna, and the text is basically the first few lines are drawn from Guhyasamaja Tantra, and so the rest of the text is commentary to these first few lines, and so this is very important. A significant text. So in the beginning, Master Nagarjuna goes through the different philosophical traditions, and then later he gives practice of, teaches the practice of cultivating bodhicitta on the basis of equaling and exchanging self and others. And so in the Ratnavali also he teaches that. And Master Shantideva's teaching on the equaling and exchanging self and others was also based on these two texts by Master Nagarjuna. And so with regard to the collection of six reasoning texts, I received it from Sergon Tsenshev Rinpoche. So it was quite a rare transmission. And then from Kunun Lama Rinpoche, I received the Mule Madhyama Kakarika. The Kinori master, Lama Tenzin Gyaltsen, and because he knew Sanskrit, he was also able to compare the Tibetan and the Sanskrit and gave me the transmission. And then I also thought that I should receive the teachings and transmissions of Master Nagarjuna's text, the collection of texts called the hymns. And so I requested the Gaden Tisur Rinpoche, the former Gaden T. Rinpoche, Rizong Rinpoche. I received this the reading transmission of the hymns by Master Nagarjuna, the collection of hymns by Master Nagarjuna, and I received it within the place where Tisur Rinpoche did his Yamantaka 3-year retreat. And of course, there is no explanatory transmission of these hymns. And then the other text that I have chosen to give teaching here is the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas, which was written by Gyatso Thokme Sangpo, who was renowned as a bodhisattva himself, literally a bodhisattva in his times. And so So in the beginning of this text, there is the 17 Nalanda masters' praise that I have written. So I'm going to read that. So the first verse is salutation to the Buddha, which says, perfectly arisen through the compassionate wish to benefit beings and be more exalted even than the gods, you have reached the supreme level of protection, abandonment and realization. So these two lines are based on Dignaga's verse of salutation to the Buddha in his Brahmana Samuchaya. And then the next line says, and you guide beings to liberation through teaching of dependent origination. So this is a teaching unique to the Buddha's teaching. And so when you are actually inspired by such a teaching, it helps to feel greatly, great admiration to the Buddha from the depths of your heart, and you would even come to tears, shed tears with joy. And it's a very helpful idea and concept for transforming one's mind. Mighty Shakyamuni, son among teachers, in devotion I pay to you, homage to you. And then next is a homage to Master Nagarjuna. You brilliantly clarify the meaning of reality itself, the ultimate intent of the Mother Pratyaparamita, with profound modes of logical reasoning based on dependent origination, founder of the middle way tradition of the supreme vehicle, prophesied by the Buddha himself, noble master Nagarjuna, to you I pray. And then next is the homage to Arya Deva. And then the third verse is the salutation to Buddha Palita, who wrote his Buddha Palita commentary on Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is very good text. And then he actually comes out with clearly mentions that of the Madhyamaka view, asserting that things are merely name. And then also somewhere in his commentary, he also mentions that if things were to have any intrinsic existence, let it be, that be so. What need is there to be? That should suffice. What is need for dependent arising? And then next is Master Bhaviveka, who was a great master, the scholar himself. And then after him is the homage to Master Chandra Kirti. So he wrote Madhyamaka Avatara, which is the meaning commentary to Mula Madhyamaka Karika, and word commentary, which is the lucid words, Prasanapada. And so he comes out clearly with, mentions clearly that about whether there is a common locus between the Madhyamakas and the Prasangikas and other philosophical schools. And next is the homage to Shandideva, the Bodhisattva Shandideva. So if you read Bodhisattva Charyavatara, you'll see how he uses reasoning to demonstrate the practice of this equaling, exchanging self and others. So showing the disadvantages, shortcomings of self-cherishing attitude and the advantage of cherishing others over oneself, making self-cherishing attitude dumbfounded. And so that is an amazing text. And then next is the homage to the abbot or Upadhyaya Chandrakshita. So I'm not able to sometimes remember names. So we have not yet recited the verse of taking refuge in Bodhicitta. Because of age, it seems that I am skipping some things. So I said that on the side of the Lama, he should be sincere in his teaching, giving teaching to others. So because we are going through the teaching, dealing with the teaching on Buddhism in general and particularly the Bodhisattva Yana, well, let us say this verse, I seek refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha until enlightenment is reached. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings through the practice of, made my practices of giving and so forth. Lead me to Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. So, regarding Master Chandideva's Shiksha Samuchaya, the compendium of practices, which is similar to Master Nagarjuna's Sutra Samuchaya, the compendium or the sutras, so, which are the two of the texts, classic texts that were followed by the Kadamba masters. And so these two texts by Master Chandideva, Shiksha Samuchaya and Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, and complement each other, where one is not so extensive, the other goes through the points extensively, and then make up for what is missing in each other. And so the Shiksha Samuchaya was written before Bodhisattva Charya Avatara by Chandideva. And then with regard to Master Shanda Dakshita, so he was a Madhyamaka master, philosopher, who followed the tradition or the system of Madhyamaka, which asserted that things have some objective existence. And he particularly followed the Yogacara sub-school of Savatantrika Madhyamaka, and the other sub-school of Savatantrika Madhyamaka is Sotrantika Savatantrika Madhyamaka, and he wrote Madhyamaka Alamkara, Ornament of the Middle Way, which we do study, and a very important text that he wrote also was Tattva Samgraha, the Compendium of Reality, and to which which is an epistemological text, and there is a commentary to it by his student Kamala Shila, there has been some lack of studying these texts by these two masters on epistemology. And I have suggested Namdoling Nyingma Institute include them text in their curriculum. And so Chandrakshita was a master who founded the Yogacara Savatantrika Madhyamaka system of philosophy. And it was someone who explained and demonstrated the truth of the philosophy through logic and reasoning. And he went to Tibet in the 8th century at the invitation of the Tibetan Emperor Tisong Detsen. And due to these three historical personalities, Abbot Chandrakshita, Master Padmasambhava, and King Tisong Detsen. And today, as Tibetans, we feel proud of the custodians, of being custodians of the Nalanda tradition. And then next comes, after the homage to Chandrakshita, we have the homage to his student, Kamala Shila. As advised and prophesied by Chandrakshita himself, there was during his time, the Samye Monastery was founded in Tibet, And there was the Department of Translation, Department of Monastic, Celibate Monastics, and then there was also the Department of Meditation, where Chinese meditators lived. Because of the Tibetan and Chinese emperor's family connection, these Chinese masters lived in the Department of Meditation. And later on, there were some Chinese meditators who said that mere meditation is enough. We don't need to do any study of the teaching of the Buddha. Even today, we have people who say this kind of thing. Some Chinese students and also people in Japanese monasteries have asked me, what is the need for study of the classic texts? I mean, why can we not be satisfied with meditation alone? And so, such a trend even appeared during that time, in those days in Tibet, because they said that distractions is not needed. We cannot, we should not proliferate, we create or cause proliferation of thought processes. We should actually channelize our thought and meditate, do thoughtlessness meditation. And so, as Chandrakshita advised and prophesied, Kamala Shila was invited to Tibet, and who he had a debate with under the auspices of the Tibetan king, debate with the Chinese meditators. And therefore, after that, at the request of the Tibetan emperor, Kamala Shila wrote the three books of stages of meditation. So I was I had wanted to receive the transmission of these the stages of meditation. And when one time I was here in Bodh Gaya, I asked Sakya Abbot Sangye Tenzin what kind of transmissions he had, and he mentioned this Bhavana Krama by Kamala Shila, and I thought it is indispensable for me to receive this, and therefore I received it from him, the transmission of this stages of meditation, and he had received it in Samye Monastery in Tibet in the old times, where one Lama from Kham was giving this teaching, and therefore he received it. So perhaps that Lama was a student of or a follower of the Kempo Shenga of the Nyingma tradition. And then after Kamala Shila comes Master Arya Asanga, who was someone who had reached the Arya Bodhisattva level, third level, and he was a practitioner of Madhyamaka philosophy himself, but as prophesied by the Buddha, he that he would appear to as a trailblazer of Chittamatra philosophy. He received the five treatises of Maitreya, where the Maitreya was a bodhisattva as a deity or a human being. And then he also wrote the Bodhisattva Bhumi and other texts. So he was the founder of the Chittamatra philosophy. And then next comes Master Vasubandhu. So he was a great top scholar who wrote Abhidhamma Kosha Karika, And then texts such as Chidamatra text, where he rejects externality, external existence, such as the 20 verses and 30 verses and so forth. So sometimes I think that in the what he wrote in the third chapter of Abhidhamma Kosha Karika about the cosmos, sorry. And so in the beginning of this Abhidhamma Kosha, he says that he uses a term which shows his own discontent. And so next is the homage to Dignaga, Master Dignaga. So regarding, he was a master of logic. He wrote the compendium of valid cognition using critical analysis to establish the teaching of the Buddha through logic. So he wrote an amazing these amazing texts. And next is the homage to Dharmakirti, who wrote the Brahmana Samuchaya commentary on the valid cognition. So the second chapter of which is a commentary to the verse of homage written by Dignaga, where he uses the reasoning to establish the meaning of the Four Noble Truths and its 16 aspects. So this was very clear to became very clear to me when I had a meeting with Thai scholars from Bangkok, from a university in Bangkok where I had visited before. So I had discussions with these scholars from Thailand in Delhi on the Four Noble Truths, the 16 aspects, and the 37 factors of enlightenment. And then I asked them, when you explain the Four Noble Truths with the 16 characteristics, I asked them whether they use reasoning, logic, or scriptural authority. And they said they resorted to scripture to explain that. And that actually let me think that Dharmakirti is using logic to prove the 16 aspects is quite amazing. And so, next is Arya Vimukti Sena, who was a student of Vasubandhu, but he wrote a commentary on Abhisamayalamkara with those of the Prajaparamita Sutras. According to the Madhyamaka tradition, Madhyamaka philosophical system, as he had found what the interpretation of his master Vasubandhu not correct, and to interpret the Abhisamaya Alamkara and the Prajaparamita text from the point of view of Chittamatra philosophical view. And so Vimukti Sena's text and Haribhadra's commentary, Abhisamaya Alamkara Aloka, the lamp of Abhisamaya Alamkara, are very important texts. And then Master Haribhadra comes next. And so his commentary, which is called the small or the short commentary on Abhisamaya Alamkara, is the text that is studied in all the monastic institutions of learning. considered very important text. And then next comes Gunaprabha, homage to Gunaprabha, with regard to the Vinaya, a master of Vinaya himself, with regard to the Vinaya tradition. The Tibetan Buddhist tradition follows that of the Mula Sarvastivada tradition that has come down to us through Master Chandrakshita. And whereas in Pali tradition that is followed in Theravada, Thailand, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Burma, and so forth, they follow that of the Theravada tradition. And so there are few differences, minor differences in the number of vows, whereas in the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, a fully ordained monk keeps 253. And so, for example, with regard to the lower garments that the monks wear, in our tradition of Vinaya text, there is mention of how to wear it. There are seven ways mentioned not to wear it too low, below the ankle, not to wear it too high, above the knees, and not to wear it too tight around your body, and so forth. Whereas in the Theravada the Vinaya tradition, it is said that the lower garment should be worn properly, just one. And so I once met few Burmese bhikshus in Melbourne in Australia at one of the World Parliament of Religions meetings. And so they wanted to see me, and I went to see them putting on these yellow robes. And then at our meeting, I explained to them that we keep, as monks, we keep all these vows. And these two monks were quite surprised when I explained to them that we have such a pure Vinaya practice. And so they were quite surprised and asked me, "Oh, do you also have this kind of Vinaya practice?" So I thought that they had the impression that the Tibetans didn't practice Vinaya, but Tantra. And the Westerners have actually called Tibetan Buddhist tradition Lamaism. So in the beginning, when I visited Japan and so forth, people were using this term, Lamaism. But as I began to, as I explained to them over and over again that we are the follower of a pure Master Nalanda tradition set down in the Tibetan land by Chandrakshita. And so, we have the Buddhist the Vinaya practice as well. So they thought that Tibetans didn't have Vinaya practice. So they were very pleased with my explanation. And then after Gunaprabha, there is the Shakyaprabha, homage to Master Shakyaprabha, another Vinaya master. And then the Master Venerable Atisha comes next. So in Tibet, since the time of Lung Dharma, Buddhism declined for several decades. There were no people, nobody wearing the monastic robes. And then later, the teaching was revived from the two sides of Tibet, one from the western, upper western part, and then one from the lower Kham region. And so there was a huge decline in the teaching of the Buddha. And so Yishi Wu and Changju were two descendants of the Tibetan and kings who really went through hardships to revive the teaching of the Buddha. And I really, when I reflect on their legacy, I feel quite sad. Because the power of Tibet declined so much, so that there was no central ruler, but only few lamas and teachers looking after their own people, and not the whole of Tibet. But later, during Dogen Chögyal Pakpa's time, the Sakya times, there seems to have been a rule over all Tibet, but that may not have been too very effective. So in those days, when Buddhism had really declined so much in Tibet, these two Tibetan personalities, Yishi Wu and Changju Wu, thought of inviting Master Atisha to Tibet. And he was invited by Changju Wu, whose uncle, Yishi Wu, actually died while in the process of inviting Atisha. And Atisha came up with the teaching of pertaining to the three beings, three types of beings with three spiritual faculties or capacities. And so, then next I have written, through these prayers of mine made with a firm mind, of vivid and unshakable faith to these most brilliant of scholars who, like ornaments, enhanced and beautified the world. And so the Nalanda tradition that we have today is something which we should be proud of in the world. And so this is due to the 17 Nalanda masters' writings. So we are able to be proud because of these writings of the 17 Nalanda masters that we study. And were the supreme sources for so many wondrous and excellent teachings, may my mind be blessed so that it is matured and brought to liberation. And then, as it is found in Abhisamaya Alamkara, in the section on instructions, there is the introduction to the teaching through the teaching on the two truths. So, this is the process because the Buddha himself has said that the sages do not wash away the sins of beings, nor do they remove the suffering of with their hands, nor do they transfer their own realization into others, but by teaching suchness or reality as it is, they lead beings to liberation. And that is talking about how the ultimate nature of things. And then Master Nagarjuna also mentions that all the teachings of the Buddhas are based on the two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. And these two truths are even mentioned in the non-Buddhist traditions, such as the Sankhya school, saying that the Prakrit or Pradhana and the conscious being are consciousness being are ultimate reality, whereas the rest of the other 25 elements are conventional truth. So in India, there was this tradition of using logic and reasoning to establish their thesis and assertions or the belief systems, whereas it's not there in the Judeo-Christian tradition, those of the Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And Zoroastrianism also seems maybe the same. All of these traditions believe in a creator God. And the followers are taught to keep faith in that God, the creator, and who in whose hands everything lies. So, of course, this is also very powerful. So everyone, all of these teachings say that God is full of love, and therefore such a God has created us, and therefore we are the God's children, and therefore we also have to practice love. So even today, the followers of Christianity set up schools and hospitals and clinics and so forth. And so Christian brothers and sisters have served humanity hugely through education, by educating people and taking care of their health. And so they have, although sometimes they also bring in the element of missionary work, converting people. For example, Mother Teresa founded the Sisters of Charity in Calcutta, and the serving, she served humanity, needy people, and this service is given on the basis of our faith in Christianity. And so, of course, philosophically, there are big differences. And therefore, in this text I have written, may I be blessed so that I plant the foundation of the path of freedom. May I understand the fundamental nature of reality and the meaning of the two truths, gain certainty about the four truths and how samsara is perpetuated and discontinued, and through valid cognition, develop stable and lasting faith in the three jewels. So, so when you have understood well the teachings of the 17 Nalanda masters, then you will be able to understand the significance and the key points of Tantra as well. So that is the end of the 17 Nalanda Master's praise. So all the marvelous explanations of the profound, in the colophon I write, profound and vast teachings excellently revealed by Lord Buddha, which were composed by these scholars from the noble land of India, can open the eyes of intelligence in anyone who has discerning awareness that these teachings are still being studied, reflected and meditated upon today, and have not diminished. And so forth, even after almost 2,550 years. So those masters were great. And then Nalanda, if you look at Nalanda today, it's just in ruins. And the main stupa, the temple of Mahabodhi temple here in Bodh Gaya, was also excavated by the British people. Otherwise, they were underground. They went submerged underground. So today, when the whole society is rather materialistic and live a materialistic way of life, and people are lost in music or beautiful sights and so forth, which give satisfaction to sensory experiences, through sensory experiences. So at this time, where the whole world has witnessed tremendous achievement in the fields of science and technology, but we are also greatly distracted by the hustles and bustles of our hectic lives, it is crucially important for us who follow the Buddha to develop faith based upon an understanding of the Buddha's teachings. So, merely stay keeping faith, following the teaching through mere faith is not going to be good. Therefore, we should investigate them by analyzing and inquiring with an unbiased and inquisitive mind. So you should be, for that you should have a skeptical mind. So unbiased and skeptical. As the 400 verses said, for someone who wishes to practice, follow the teaching of the Buddha, he or she should be unbiased, intelligent, and have the aspiration to follow the teaching. So with this kind of unbiased and skeptical mind, one should investigate the teaching. If we are to develop this faith that is supported by understanding the outstanding works of the profound and vast traditions composed by the Masters, universally renowned as the six ornaments of two supreme ones, as well as others such as Buddha Palita and Arya Vimukti Sen, are indispensable. With this in mind, I commissioned the painting of a Thanka depicting 17 of the most learned and accomplished Masters of Nalanda, adding 9 other masters from the profound and the vast lineages of the traditional Thangka arrangements for the ornaments and 2 supreme ones. So I related this to commission making the Thangka painting of 17 Nalanda masters to Tishi Rinpoche as well. And so, together with this, I felt inspired to compose a prayer such as this out of heartfelt devotion to these great Nalanda masters and several of my sincere Dharma friends who also encouraged me. So here, Dharma friends includes the late Trishi Rinpoche. He's always commented. So it was that I, the Buddhist monk Tenzin Gyatso, who has gained confidence and contrived faith in the excellent works of these learned masters and belongs amongst the lowest of those to have studied and the masterful compositions, wrote this prayer to kindle the 3 kinds of faith addressed to the 17 great panditas of glorious Nalanda. It was completed in Thekchen Choring Dharamsala, Kangra, Himachal Pradesh, India, on the first day of the 11th month of the iron year in the 17th calendrical cycle, 2001. So it is very important for us to study the classic texts. So these texts written by the 17 Nalanda masters deal with the general structure of the teaching of the Buddha, whereas the Tantra deals with the specialized teachings. And therefore, merely following the specialized teachings will not, we will not be able to make much progress. And so, we have the 13 classic texts, great treatises, to which Kenpo Shienga has written annotations, but then mere annotation will not give you decisive understanding. Whereas if you follow the pattern of learning through challenging others' positions, establishing one's own, and rebuttal of criticism to your position, then you will be able to gain a decisive understanding of the teaching. And therefore, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we have all the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism have this practice of studying the text, classic text. So we cannot just follow on the teaching that I follow this because it is my master's instruction. We should follow the classic texts. So in Sanskrit, the Bodhicitta Vivarana, in Tibetan, Changjusen Gyedelpa, and homage to glorious Vajrasattva. And so the verse from Guhyasamacha Tantra comes next. Devoid of all real entities, utterly discarding all objects and subjects, and so forth. So this is the root text of Guhyasamacha Tantra. So the first line, devoid of all real entities. Refers to, of course, we have in India the non-Buddhist traditions and Buddhist tradition, and then there are the theistic religious traditions in the world. From the West. And the Indian traditions relate past and future lives. The Indian traditions have said that there must be a self, an Atman, which comes from the past to this life and goes from here to the next life. And this Atman or self is separate from the psychophysical aggregates which go through in disintegration, while the self cannot go through disintegration, that it is asserted as being permanent, single and autonomous. And the Rigan Jainism, which does not believe in a creator God, and then the theistic, non-theistic Sankhya school, which do not assert a creator God, though they don't reject creator God, they still believe in or assert that of a permanent self. So this verse says that there is nothing that is a permanent creator or a self which is permanent. So I have deep respect to the followers or practitioners of Christianity, not just in words. I really have seen Christian practitioners who are really sincere practitioners of their religion. For example, in Barcelona, I once met a Christian practitioner.
Catholic monk.
I'm switching.
So this Christian monk who spent about 5 years in the mountains without having any solid foods, but having just bread and water, and he came to see me. So really, I develop a sense of great appreciation and respect to him, for he have lived in such a hermit life for over 5 years. So I told him that I have heard that you have stayed for 5 years as meditative yogi, and what are you practicing in all those time? I asked him, and he told me that he was meditating and practicing compassion. And while saying that, while expressing that, he was stout and short-bodied. And his eyes, while expressing those words, that he's practicing compassion, so in his eyes there is a glittering a sparkling and special signs in his eyes when he expressed that he has very strong faith to the God as the Creator, and also following the instructions and the teachings of the God, and the main teaching to practice compassion and 4 or 5 years. And this is also similar to what our teachings on the in Sutra states about the practicing of the four important factors. Of the four practices of the Arya, among them one of is to live an ascetic life and so on. So the followers of the Christianity and many great practitioners, I have many of them personally I know, and also I have similar friends in Islam who are Muslims and also Hindu masters and friends. Of course, they are of great help to so many people, and they are really still very relevant to this modern world. So we have to genuinely generate a deep respect to all these different traditions. But when it comes to the philosophical view, it is very difficult to prove or ascertain the view, the philosophical view that is coming from the theistic tradition. So this first verse, devoid of all real entities, it says that if we have to subject those philosophical views that is coming from the theistic religions, it is very difficult to prove. And the third line, such as aggregates, elements, and sense fields, so this is actually negating the views of the hearer and the solitary realizers, the two other practitioners. And also, one's mind is primordially unborn and due to the sameness of all selflessness of all phenomena. So this also negates the view of the mind-only school, and finally confirming and establishing the Madhyamika philosophical as the ultimate. So continue reading from page number 97. Just as the blessed Buddhas and the great Bodhisattvas have generated the mind of great awakening, I too shall from now until I arrive at the heart of awakening, generate the awakening mind in order that I may save those who are not saved. Saved. So His Holiness comment that before on the verse, we spoke about the generation of the wisdom, and this phrase is spoke about, tell us about the generation of the great awakening mind, the bodhicitta. Those bodhisattvas who practice by means of the secret mantra, after having generated awakening mind in terms of its conventional aspect, in the form of an aspiration. Solanus comments that for practitioners of the Vajrayana Tantra, it is very important to have the generation of the bodhicitta as the foundation of all the practices. And as the Buddha Balita speaks of on the 400 verses, that first we have to eliminate the 10 non-virtuous actions, and then after that gradually develop the wisdom realizing emptiness. So this is the actual order of the teachings of the Buddha. So in order to attain the Buddhahood, which is omniscient, the state of omniscience, it is important to achieve it through the wisdom realizing emptiness, having the antidote of all the afflicted emotions. So therefore, in the 400 verses, it says that first we have to eliminate the 10 non-virtuous actions, activities. Then in the middle time also eliminates the graspings of the self and so on. And ultimately eliminate all the obscurations to omniscient. And this is the teaching of Buddha. So first verse, bowing to the glorious worship holder who embodies the awakening mind. I shall explain here the meditative practice of awakening mind that destroys cyclic existence. And here when we speak about the ultimate bodhicitta, So this is also referring to the self as being conceived or understood. The gross level of the understanding of selflessness coming from the two classes of the hearer and the solitary realizers. The second verse, the Buddhas maintain the awakening mind to be not obscured by such conceptions as consciousness of self aggregates and so on. It is always characterized by emptiness. It is with the mind, motioned by compassion, that you must cultivate with effort. The Buddhas who embody great compassion constantly develop this awakening mind. The self postulated by the extremists, when you thoroughly analyze it with reasoning, within all the aggregates of body and mind, now where can you find a locus for this? So verse number 7, such since a permanent cannot function in gradual or instantaneous terms, so both without and within no such permanent entity exists. And verse number 8, if it were potent, why it would be dependent? So this is also, this verse speaks about negating the self as independent, unitary, and as single, as being asserted by the non-Buddhist schools. Verse number 10. This world devoid of self and so on is utterly vanquished by the notions of aggregates, elements and sense fields, and that of object and subject. So this seems to be a little mistake here, but there is no commentary to make sure whether it's correct or not. The verse number 11. Those who seek to help others has taught to the disciples the five aggregates, form, feelings, perception, volitional forces, and consciousness. And when it comes to the explanation of the impermanence and the selflessness and so on, so there are two explanations. One, first taking into those impermanence nature of the phenomena and so on a grosser level, and also a more subtle level. So when things, usually when they are established as impermanent due to the origins and the causes, so in this way, the correct order of the first truth, that is the truth of suffering, and its four aspects as impermanent, suffering, and emptiness, and selflessness. So this order makes a sense here. And especially the aggregates are by nature formed by elements, and especially referring to the form, it is formed by the aggregating so many different elements, as it is explained in the Ratnavali. And reading from verse number 16, neither atoms of form exist, nor is sense organ elsewhere. Even more, no sense organ as agent exists, so the producer and the produced are utterly unsuited for production. So here, the very minute atom itself does not have the potential to produce the sensory consciousness. So since these minute particles individually do not have the capacity or the potential to produce the sense consciousness and sense organs, so therefore it is the collection of this minute particles that combine together forms a grosser body or a form from which the sensory consciousness happened. And verse number 18 and 19 is actually negating the views of the proponents of externalism, which are the Vaibhashika and the Sutra school. And verse number 20, with respect to the same female body, three different notions are entertained by the ascetic, the lustful, and the dog as a corpse, an object of lust or food. So Solon has comments here that just merely for one object, one common object, so due to the different observers, so different notions of an object arises. So verse number 23, so from here onwards explains about the exertions of the views of the mind-only school. And so there are no external objects at all existing in the mode of entities. So this is also very similar, very corresponding to what the quantum physics speaks about, the nature of the form, when the sensory perceptions observe a phenomena in front of them as a form which is in front of them. So the object, the form, which is in front of the eye consciousness, when we further subject them to critical analysis, whether they exist in the same way, there is no way that we can find that external object. And one of my friend, who is a quantum physicist, told me that as long as there is the observer or the mind that observes the object, so the object exists. So without as the observer ceases to exist, so then the object also ceases with them. So this is similar to what the mind-only schools speaks about, having the same the object and the observers being not different from each other in terms of their originations. So these both assertions coming from the mind-only school is very similar to what the modern physicist explains. Just as a person whose mind is deluded sees magical illusions and mirages, and the cities of Gandhavara spirits, so to forms and so on are perceived. And verse number 25 also speaks about the assertions of mind-only schools. So His Holiness comments that since the mind-only school, even though they do not speak about the absence of an external object, but the mind as a true existent phenomena, so when we subject that to, again, the observer or the mind to further subjectivity and experiments, whether they do have an inherent existence, so these assertions and the notions that is coming from the mind-only schools also cease to prove. And verse number 27, this is a quotation, actually a proof for the assertions of the mind-only school. All of this is but one's mind, that which was stated by the able one, is to alleviate the fear of the childish. It is not of truth. And verse number 28, the imputed, the dependent, and the consummate, they have only one nature of their own emptiness. Their entities are constructed upon the mind. So these are the three states of phenomena as explained by the mind-only schools. The first one, the imputed phenomena. The imputed phenomena can be further categorized into one that is mere the object of negations, and the other, the mere imputed phenomena. And the imputed phenomena in terms of object of negations. So all the dependent phenomena, by nature of them being devoid or free of the imputed phenomena, which is the object of negation, is explained here as the ultimate truth. And in the Sutra of the Perfection Wisdom, that from the form and all the aggregates as being empty of inherent existence, so if you take the literal meaning of those texts, then it may come to our mind as the non-existence of any phenomena in this world. So therefore, in the third turning of the will, So His Holiness comments here that in the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, so Lord Buddha make a division in these three classifications, that the dependent phenomena do not have their intrinsic reality in terms of their originations, and the imbued phenomena do not have their own inherent existence. So they drew a classification between these three categories of the phenomena. So, the verse that all the phenomena do not have their own inherent existence. So verse number 29, to those who delight in the great vehicle, the Buddha taught in brief, selflessness is perfect equanimity. So this speaks about the middle way philosophy and also the ultimate view of the Mayana. So not even the external objects, but even the observer also do not have their own objective existence. Verse number 30. So, as the mind-only school speaks about the consciousness as having its intrinsic existence, so when you put them into critical analysis, of course, they do not have a form appearance. So you cannot divide or disintegrate the mind in form of that. But in the terms of their arising, the former arising and the later arising, so in terms of their continuity, we can break further and understood the consciousness as not having its own entity. And verse number 33, from here onwards, it negates the assertion of the mind-only schools as consciousness as having its entities. By being close to a lodestone, an iron object swiftly moves forward. It possesses no mind, yet it appears as it does. And mind-only school also speaks about a collection of the eight minds, eight consciousness, and the analeya or the fundamental mind. And this terminology is also coming from the Vajrayana teachings, Vajrayana texts also. Just as the ocean and the trees, verse number 35, move about though they possess no mind, likewise foundational consciousness too move about in dependence upon the body. So if it is considered that without a body there is no consciousness, His Holiness comments that these verses negate the assertion of the nature of the phenomena by the Vaibhashika and the other schools. And it is important to first study and understand the different levels of the selflessness that is being taught by the Buddha in terms of its grosser level and the very subtle level. So Lord Buddha has taught a different in various texts about some contradictory notions. And when we further subject them to a critical analysis, so we find contradiction between these understandings. So, when we found the contradictions between all these assertions in the philosophical views, then we have to negate and move forward. And ultimately, when it comes to the middle way philosophies, the Madhyamika schools' explanations of the emptiness and the selflessness, then we cannot find any contradiction to those explanations. So, which is the ultimate explanations? And this is a teaching of the Tibetan arising, and that as Nagarjuna states, there is not a phenomena that is not, whatever the phenomena is empty of existence, is by nature Tibetan arising. And all the Tibetan arising is by nature empty. So taking the Tibetan arising as a reason to prove that the things do not have their own objective existence. So So things, when subject to such critical analysis, we come to the conclusion that they do not have their inherent existence. So if they do not have an inherent existence, they do exist in a conventional way. So this is called the illusory existence. So therefore, as the Chandrakriti says, that when subject to the 7-point reasoning and analysis towards the establishing the selflessness, we cannot find there any objective existence, but they do exist in the form of as it is known to the general world. And most of the Geshe scholars here have understand the essence of the teachings by the on the interpretable and definitive by Lama Tsongkhapa. And so in this text, Lama Tsongkhapa has quoted many sources from Chandrakriti's text when it comes to the negation of the selflessness. So since things ultimately can be established only as a label, only as a label and name, and so things exist as it is known to us, and also this is the first category, first criteria, and second, that there is should not be any other conventional valid cognitions that will negate the existence of this thing. So in this way, we will be able to establish the nature of this conventional phenomenon. Verse number 39, the cognizer perceives the cognizable. Without the cognizable, there is no cognition. Therefore, why do you not admit that neither object nor subject exists? The mind is but a mere name. Apart from its name, it exists as nothing. So, view consciousness as a mere name. Name too has no intrinsic nature. Verse number 43, in brief, the Buddhas have never seen, nor will they ever see such a mind. So how can they see it as intrinsic nature, that which is devoid of intrinsic nature? So when things appear to our diluted mind, things appear as having their own objective existence. And as I said before, when you subject them to further experiment and investigations, and when we come to the point that we cannot even put our finger or a point of, we cannot even find any point of reference from their objective side, so that is called the understanding of emptiness. As we have said before, so I do not remember it now. Entity is a conceptualization. Absence of conceptualization is emptiness. Where conceptualization occurs, how can there be emptiness? Verse number 46, devoid of characteristics and origination, devoid of substantive reality and transcending speech, space awakening mind and enlightenment possess the characteristics of non-duality. And we can think in this way, in the way of finding the reality, whether we find from the objective side or from the observer, the mind subjective side also. If we speak from the Vajrayana teachings, the mind can be further categorized into the gross or the subtle. The gross level of the mind is very advantageous. It comes from the certain, but the very subtle mind is the actual mind that understand, that will become enlightened. So the grosser level of the mind that we have, so once that mind becomes clear by eliminating all the obscurations, so this mind in continuity will become enlightened in the subtle mind. So these minds, by moment, they changes, but they are not able to find their actual objective existence. And this is similar to as in the spring, as in the sky, in the rainy sky, that the clouds form. And when it comes to the different reasons, and the various of reasons, the finding the objective reality of the things from their causal side and also from their result side and from the both causal and result side. So when we subject them to through these kind of reasonings, though they exist conventionally, but they cannot be proved their existence objectively. Verse number 48, therefore constantly meditate on this emptiness, the basis of all phenomena, tranquil and illusion-like, groundless and disturber of cyclic existence. As I said before, that as the body faculty spreads over all our body, and similarly the ignorance forms as the source of all the other afflicted emotions. So therefore, by eliminating the ignorance, which is the source of all the other afflicted emotions, we will be able to eliminate all the other afflicted emotions. So therefore, it is only through the understanding of dependent arising. Therefore, this has been taught here at the beginning. And this can be also proved through the quantum physicists in nowadays. And as in the fundamental wisdom that all the phenomena will cease to exist in the form of emptiness. From the chapter 24, the three poisons, attachment, and so on, they arise through misconceptions. And this verse is from the fundamental wisdom. So when you will look at the desire objects and the undesired objects, and to create a distinction, having a very strong sense of attachment and anger towards the desire and the undesired objects. So such kind of the strong desire, such kind of very strong mind and conceptual graspings, when they cease to exist after further analyzations, so then we tend to come to a time where it is not able to, where we won't be able to get a strong anger or desire towards these two objects. So therefore, from this distorted mental conceptions, misconceptions, distorted misconceptions, brings out the attachments and the true graspings. So therefore, it is important to stop, first eliminate those distorted misconceptions, so that the true graspings and the attachment doesn't arise after that. And when we understand the true nature of the things is not having its own existence, so it loses the true grasping minds, lose their foundation and the basis. And when these bases are distorted and destroyed, then those misconceptions also cease to exist in us. So the nature of the things are like illusion-like. They do not have inherent existence, but they have a nominal existence. So this is similar to an illusion. As I've stated before by the 7th Dalai Lama's verse, I am the yogi of the non-arising, similar to the space. And this union of the bliss, this union of the appearance and the reality, so I took delight in this practice. And also in the four mindfulness coming from the 7th Dalai Lama. In this world of the colorful, things appear to us, and so many different colorful things appear to us. And within that, we will be able to find the emptiness nature of the things. So we have to meditate, and we have to practice. We have to meditate on them. So otherwise, we won't be able to generate such kind of understanding. Verse number 50, the notions of virtue and non-virtue, characterized by being disintegrated, the Buddha has spoken of the emptiness. Other than this, no emptiness is held. The abiding of a mind which is no object is defined as the characteristic of space. They accept that meditation on emptiness is a meditation on space. His Holiness comments that when we speak about things as depending upon each other and being designated upon another factor, and this is we're referring to generating an understanding that things do not exist as it appears to our mind. And when we come to that point, we are able to destroy the basis of the true grasping. And having that understanding also, at the same time, looking at all the phenomena as existing by nominal and conventionally. Verse number 52, with the lion's roar of emptiness, all pronouncements are frightened. His Holiness comments that as we have discussed in the praise of dependent origination by Lama Tsongkhapa Des, when we cease to, when we develop our understanding, where there cease to have any contradictions between the earlier and the later part of his teachings, so then we develop genuine respect to the Buddha. Verse number 53, to whom consciousness is momentary, the fourth line, how could it be the inconsistent with emptiness? So His Holiness feels that this may be a little bit incorrect. And verse number 54, in brief, if the Buddhas uphold the mind to be impermanent, how would they not uphold that it is empty as well? So things, since they are by nature dependent arising, so therefore they rely on their causes and the changes happened. And existence of the oneself and everything depend upon other factors and the causes. So therefore, we are empty of inherent independent existence. So when we speak about the emptiness, so things are empty of their existence since they are formed or originated. So therefore, this is taken as the metaphor here with relate to the molasses. The verse number 57, just as sweetness is the nature of molasses and heat the nature of fire, likewise we maintain that the nature of all phenomena is emptiness. And the verse number 58 speaks about the nature of the thing as neither falling on nihilism or eternalism. And verse number 59 onward speaks about why the importance of the wisdom realizing emptiness, starting with ignorance and ending with aging. So this dual interdependent link from ignorance and aging is taught in all the sutras, in the Mahayana and Theravada sutras. And this is also, as we have discussed in the Rice Settling Sutra. Continue reading, all processes that arise from the 12 links of dependent origination, we accept them to be like a dream and an illusion. His Holiness comments that self do not exist as different from the aggregates, and self is not also an independent agent that controls the aggregate. So aggregates cannot be found upon further subject to analysis. So similarly, self, which is the agent, cannot be also found when further subject to reasoning and experiments. Verse number 63, in brief, from empty phenomena arises, agent, karma, fruits, and their enjoyer. The conqueror taught this to be conventional. So this is referring to that since things are empty of their nature, so within that emptiness, things do have their existence. and the agent, and also the one who enjoys the result. And these are all, these all conventional things has to be established in a conventional or nominal way, but they do not have an inherent existence. Verse number 65, that phenomena are born from causes can never be inconsistent, since the cause is empty of cause. We understand it to be empty of origination. His Holiness comments that things, when we subject them to any kind of reasons, whether it's from the point of cause or pertaining to the result, so they cannot be found of their objective existence. Verse number 68 speaks about the conventional truth and also the ultimate truth. The conventional is taught to be emptiness. The emptiness itself is the conventional. One does not occur without the other, just as produced and impermanent. This is similar to the fourfold emptiness, that form is empty, and emptiness is also form, and so on. Verse number 69, the conventional arises from afflictions and karma, and karma arises from the mind. The mind is accumulated by the propensities. When free from propensities, it's happiness. Verse number 71, it's described as suchness and as the reality limit, as singleness and as the ultimate truth. And verse number 72, His Holiness comments that those who do not understand emptiness are not receptive vehicle for liberations. Such ignorant beings will revolve in the existence prisons of six classes of beings. When this emptiness is thus meditative upon by yogis, so when we meditate on the emptiness, we sense to gain understanding and encouragement within us that those afflicted emotions can be defeated. And when it comes to the meaning of the cessation, so here cessation, which is by nature a peace, a quality of peace. So here the peace is not just an absence of the afflicted emotions, but very supreme state of a state where all these afflicted emotions has been defeated. So this is with respect to the four aspects of the truth of cessations, that the peace and so on. So if we are able to gain such an understand, then when you look at the other sentient beings and animals, that since even though they do not want any sufferings, but ultimately engage, automatically engages in the causes of the sufferings. So the real, the ultimate enemy of ours, which brings us all this harmful harm and the sufferings, is the true grasping. And it is only the wisdom realizing selflessness that is the true antidote of the grasping, which is the understanding of selflessness. And those who develop wrong views, pertaining wrong conceptions, pertaining to the emptiness, and not being able to draw a distinction between appearance and reality, and merely take the appearance as the ultimate reality, and from it generate a lot of afflicted emotions, then it generates the karma, and from that again a lot of continuous rebirth to the samsara. So if we are able to generate the wisdom realizing emptiness, then through that we will be able to generate a strong compassion towards all the sentient beings, that in understanding in this way, that these sentient beings, even though they should be able to find the origins of their sufferings and all the harmful things that happens to them, but without understanding reality, they are going under that influence. So in this way, we will be able to generate great compassions to this all the sentient beings through the wisdom realizing emptiness. Verse number 75, so till here is meditating on the ultimate bodhicitta. till verse number 78. So, 17, from the verse number 79, as hell beings, as animals, and as hungry ghosts, and so on. The different kinds of sufferings which sentient beings experience, these come from the harming others. And this is similar to what Shantideva states, that all the sufferings come to self-cherishing thought and so on. So if that is the case, then what happens to all the great beings and the scholars and the practitioners? And the only lacking here is that they do not have the practice of great compassions, thinking about the sufferings of all the sentient beings. And the verse number 81, and taking into account all these explanations, and the way the true graspings bring all the afflicted emotions, similar to that, the grasping of the self and the true existence, though they are two different graspings and not totally similar to each other, but the way they bring the afflicted emotions after that is similar. So His Holiness didn't read one verse. And I've already read it. So I'm just also... I've also read all these verses. And also, I've quoted the text from Shantideva. So I'm here to read from this verse number 79. So in this way, you can say that you haven't read the later part of the text also. So whether we are able to attain the Buddhahood is actually dependent upon whether we have the bodhicitta or not. And the awakening mind here, the bodhicitta here, is an intention to liberate all the sentient beings from the suffering. And only through the attainment of this mind, we will be able to become enlightened. And as we usually do the practice of the mind training, we have to recollecting the gratefulness of the Buddha has been paid a great importance. And also, ultimate attainment of the liberation is also need to arise from the three trainings. And these three trainings are based on restraining from inflicting harms on other sentient beings. And so when it comes to even the attainment of a human rebirth and the next and subsequent good rebirth is also depending about not harming other peoples. So all these attainments are coming with depending upon the sentient beings. And sentient beings therefore become so important to us. And if we are able to generate a kind of a mind that we are equal, all the sentient beings, then it will be very beneficial. If you become biased and draw a distinction between these animals and the sentient beings, then you will be left without friends. And if you look even for the almsseekers and the beggars, if you consider them as the lower society or the lower people, then it will bring more problems to us. Even for the dogs, for take an instance, if you hit a dog or curse on the dog, of course, it won't benefit anyone. So not need to speak about the permanent attainment of enlightenment or the liberations. Even the temporary or the immediate attainment, such as a good human rebirth. And also if you take, for example, the fame and the food and the wealth that we need for this life, all of these attainments and accomplishments are related to the animals. And so our food is also related to all the other sentient beings. The clothes that we wear also has to come from other sentient beings. And also your fame and your name, which you care so much about, has to also happen in dependent upon other people. And all these ripening results, all these kind of accomplishments and the results has to come in dependent upon some sentient beings. This is verse number 77. If by relying upon the sentient beings, the unexcelled state is brought about, so what is so astonishing about the fact that whatever prosperities that are in the gods and humans, such as those enjoyed by Brahma, Indra and Rudra, and so on, and also taking rebirth in the lower realms and sufferings, all these kind of sufferings also comes into relation to other sentient beings. And take, for example, once in a lifetime, if you are suspicious of other people and not trusting anyone, so even within this own life, at the very moment of our existence, we tend to have more suffering. And verse number 79, as hell beings, as animals, and as hungry ghosts, the different kinds of sufferings which sentient beings experience, these come from harming others. His Holiness comments, on this earth, everyone is equal in the nature of not wishing suffering. And even scientists say that the nature of humans and all sentient beings is compassionate. Then look at all the problems caused by the humans in this world. If we have a small, if we are able to increase the intensity of the others cherishing thought within us, a lot of the problems and the harms in this world will be decreased. And all the problems in this world arises due to the self-cherishing thought, whether one believes in any religion or not. Others cherishing thought is very important, and one has to work as much as possible to practice that. And without paying any attention or importance to the others cherishing thought, and constantly under the influence of the self-cherishing thought, in even in this life you will be friendless, without any friends, and in the next and subsequent lives you will be reborn in the health and other lower realms. If we contemplate and practice the others cherishing thought, not only the next and subsequent life, even this life will be very prosperous. As the Shantideva says, once we take the right of the bodhicitta, it will bring us from higher to higher happiness. Verse number 81, and there is I'm not very sure about this verse number 81, and I could not even read some commentaries. So I'm trying to explain what things are, what I could make some sense out of this verse. Verse number 82, support others with all possible factors and so on. His Holiness comments that if there is the decrease in the others cherishing thought within us, then we have to be vigilant and point to ourselves that this should not be happened. And if we are able to increase the intensity of the others cherishing thought, then we have to rejoice in it and also take it as a pride, that this will bring the ultimate and all the temporary happiness within us. Verse number 83, because of their detachment, did not the disciples attain lesser awakening by never abandoning the sentient beings? And verse number 84, thus when one considers the occurrence of the fruits of beneficial and non-beneficial deeds. And verse number 85, rooted firmly because of compassion and arising from the shoot of awakening mind. The awakening that is the sole fruit of altruism, thus the conqueror's children cultivate. So without having the wisdom realizing emptiness, we won't be able to get to the point that suffering is something that can be eliminated. So from the understanding of emptiness, we can see that the truth of cessation is something that we can attain, and that the causes of the suffering can be eliminated. Verse number 88, that is more amazing than amazing, that is more wondrous than wondrous. Those who understand this emptiness of phenomena, yet conform to the law of karma and its results. those who wish to save sentient beings, even if they're reborn in the mires of existence. As His Holiness comments that, as Shantideva explains, in the engaging in the deeds of the Bodhisattva, we tend to practice the bodhicitta, it will be able to gain a peace, a long-lasting peace in our mind. The bodhisattvas such as Samantabhadra have burned the wood of afflictions with the wisdom fire of emptiness, they still remain moistened by compassion. Those under the power of compassion, His Holiness comments that from the Nagarjuna's precious garland, and may I be able to attain and benefit the sentient beings even after my enlightenment. So this is a very strong prayer. Verse number 91, those under the power of compassion display acts of departing, birth and merriment, renouncing kingdom, engaging in ascetic penance, great avaining and defeating the Maras. The great noble deeds of Lord Buddha is enlightenment, and also the accumulations for the 3 eons actually arises from the great sense of the bodhicitta practice within us. So sometimes when we think about the 3 eons of accumulations, we get frightened that this may not be possible. But attainment of enlightenment in this life can be achievable. So this kind of conviction or the sense within us is also attached to the self-cherishing thought. So the prayers of the Bodhisattva that as long as there are sentient beings to benefit, may I to remain to dispel their sufferings is great prayer and great inspiration and encouragement. Number 93, in guises of Brahma, Indra and Vishnu, and that of fierce Rudra forms, and they perform the compassionate dance, what acts bring peace to the beings? Verse number 94, for those disheartened on existence road, for their respite, the two wisdom that lead to the great vehicle that has been taught, they are not ultimate. So long not exhorted by Buddhas, so long the disciples will remain in a bodily state of wisdom, soon and intoxicated by absorption. When exhorted then in diverse forms, they will become attached to others' welfare. And if they gather stories of merit and wisdom, they will attain the Buddha's awakening. Verse number 99, the instructions differ as the profound and the vast, or on some occasions an instruction is characterized by both. Though such diverse approaches are taught, they are all equal in being empty and non-dual. The generation of great compassions through the wisdom realizing emptiness, and the compassion also here, the ability to liberate all the sentient beings from their sufferings. And as I stated before, that the wisdom focuses on the enlightenment, is so this makes sense here. Hundred and two, neither in cyclic existence nor in nirvana the great beings reside. Therefore, the Buddha taught here the non-abiding nirvana. The single taste of compassion is merit. The taste of emptiness is most excellent. Those who drink to realize self and others' welfare are conqueror's children. Verse number 106, to accomplish self and others' welfare, no other means exist in the world. So for one's own sake and even for others' sake, we have to practice bodhicitta. And for the health, good health for our body, and also the happy mind, and even for the need of one's friends and good company, we have to also practice compassion. So practicing compassion, practicing bodhicitta is the root of all these achievements. It is the offerings that we met is of course great, but a moment of meditating and practicing bodhicitta, the merit is enormous and much more fourfold. I've seen that there are many people who are meditating near the Mahabodhisattva Stupa, and this is really important. If possible, also meditate on emptiness and bodhicitta. And if you are able to meditate even for 1 hour, you gain either merits to dispel all the negativities for that you have accumulated for thousands of years and eons. Verse number 107, the merit that is obtained from mere generation of awakening mind, if it were to assume a form, it will feel more than the expanse of space. 109, a precious mind that is free of afflictions, and this is the most unique and excellent jewel, since bodhicitta is a qualification, a quality that is related to one's mind. So nobody can snatch it away from you, or there is no fear of losing it as we lose our possessions, objective possessions. It can be neither harmed nor stolen by such robbers as the manner of afflictions. Just as aspirations of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas are unswerving, likewise those who immerse themselves in awakening mind must hold firm their thought. By praising the awakening mind hailed by the excellent conquerors, the incomparable merits I have obtained today from this act, may through this all sentient beings submerge in the waves of excellent ocean, travel on the bird trodden by the leaders of bipeds. This concludes the commentary on awakening mind composed by great master Arya Nagarjuna. It was translated and edited by Indian Abbot Gunakara, and translator Rabshi Shinyan was later revised by Indian Abbot and Tibetan translator. So this the next is actually a mere commentary or only commentary of the first verse.
So Colin is commenting, reading another Tibetan text, which is also called Bodhicitta Vivarana, a commentary on the awakening mind. In Tibetan, there's no translation here in the text, but this particular text is a commentary to the verse from Goya Samaja Tantra. Just a commentary to the Goya Samaja Tantra lines that was found in the beginning of their previous text. So with regard to the assertion that there is a person from within the psychophysical aggregates, these philosophical schools assert that the sixth consciousness or the mind, mental consciousness, is the instance of or the identity of a person. But if you do critical analysis into the nature of this sixth mental consciousness, I mean, you'll not be able to actually assert even this is the person. So with regard to the four elements that are mentioned here, these are not just fire, water, and so forth, but the subtler unit of fire and so forth, such as cohesiveness, solidity, heat, and the that of the lightness. And so in Ratnavali, Master Nagarjuna says that so you cannot find something that is called a form or matter apart from these subtle elements that constitute such form and so forth. And so the entity of a form is mere name. And it is mentioned in that text that the space itself is mere name. And when you cannot find the basic unit that make up the matter, how can there be something called form? And therefore, the mere name itself has no real existence. So usually we think when we say that such and such thing is name, mere label, it gives some kind of impression that the name or the label could have some kind of a power, and it's often in itself, but that does not stand, that is not true. And then you actually, when you think along these lines, it gives an understanding that nothing whatever has any intrinsic existence, and you are left in this empty perception of things being empty. So the text goes through explaining that the what we call a form aggregate is itself devoid of any intrinsic anything that we can pinpoint as being the body. So going through the five aggregates, and similarly it is the case with feeling, perception, and so forth. And with regard to the mind, it does not abide in the object, it does not abide in any direction, it has no form. It cannot be shown, and it does not abide anywhere utterly, and no appearance, and is imperceptible. And therefore, what is a feeling? And as such, the mental factor does not exist or is not established. And therefore, the aggregate of feeling is devoid of the aggregate of feeling and so forth, which are said, stated, show that the aggregate of feeling does not utterly utterly not established, and perception, the aggregate of perception, is an entity which is mere name. So perception or discernment is that mental factor which has the nature of perceiving or apprehending these signs in things. And so since there is nothing, no object or entity which can be apprehended as having some kind of a fixation, therefore, since there is no fixated object, the things do not have any characteristic. And so it is similarly explained in with regards to other the compositional factor. So with regard to the So with regards to the line, utterly discarding all objects and subjects, the commentary follows. So in the secret sutra of the secret of the Tathagata, the Buddha states the mind does not have any color such as blue, yellow, red, and crystal color, and there of a silver, and then it has no sides such as being long or short, spherical, triangle, square, or four-sided, and so forth. So in this way, the nature of the person is checked. So of course, saying that things when here when you say the man does not have the nature of space and so forth, it doesn't mean that it does not exist at all. But when you analyze and try to search for the identity of the mind itself, nothing can be found, nothing can be pinpointed as being it. And in the lecture in Yingpo, essence of true eloquence, Jerembuche mentions that there's two ways things can exist. Either it could actually exist objectively or be merely imputed. And it says that since when you use critical analysis, the former cannot be established. I mean, there's no other choice but to say the things are imputed. And then in the ocean of reasoning, Master's commentary to Mula Madhyamaka Karika, Master Tsongkhapa says that since there is no other option, you should try to drive your mind towards that. Because the commentary goes on to say that sentient beings are maddened by the three poisons, and therefore one should determine to help them out of to free them from the samsara and generate bodhicitta. So I have no idea. I mean, I don't remember whether I have received the reading transmission of this text or not, but it is a nice text. And then we'll do, so we are done with the commentary on Awakening Mind. And tomorrow we'll go through the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas, which will not take much time, since we have people from different countries gathered here. The day after tomorrow, I'll do the Avalokiteshvara, Great Compassionate Deity Initiation, which falls within the tantric category of teachings. So we'll do the ceremony for Bodhicitta tomorrow, and based on Arya Sangha's Bodhisattva Bhumi, the section on ethics. This is mentioned in Master Tsongkhapa's commentary to this chapter on ethics. And so, since the tradition has almost kind of gone out of existence, and I actually re-established this practice of taking the Bodhisattva vows on the basis of this text by Asanga. And before that, we'll do the Ma Upasaka vows or precepts. As it is said in Tantra, the fourfold disciple, which comprise the two male and female lay people with vows, and then the bhikshus and bhikshunis make up the fourfold sangha, and so fourfold sangha members. And so I'll do this. The Upasaka, the layperson's vows, and the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas. I have received the explanation, transmission from Kunalama Rinpoche Tenzin Gyatsen. And then we'll do the Upasaka vows, and then the Bodhicitta ceremony. And then day after tomorrow, we'll do the initiation of the Great Compassionate Deity. Tomorrow we'll start around, like today, same time, 9 o'clock. We'll start at 9 o'clock. So it would be better to start at 9 so that we don't have to worry about.
Get the chill at Sunny.